There are many unique issues that men and women face when teaching in rural Alaska, and many big challenges. A shortage of textbooks and classroom supplies, subsistence seasons, fluctuating populations, what some people are calling the mass exodus to more populated regions. These are just some of the factors that might make it difficult for teachers. But there are also those that make teaching in the bush a joyous and life-changing experience. Hello, I'm Tika Ballas, your host this week for Hometown Alaska. Today, my guests and I will discuss teaching in rural Alaska. We hope you'll call in and share with us the obstacles and joys that make teaching experiences in rural Alaska a unique one, or call up with any questions or advice my guests may be able to assist you with. Today, I have in the studio with me Tim Jester, Associate Professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage's College of Education and Coordinator of the Elementary Education Teacher Education Program. Tim taught for 5 years in the Yupik School District and now sends students teachers to school in Alaska Native Villages for a two-week field experience. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
And on the phone with us is Shirley Holloway. She was a superintendent and principal with the North Slope Borough School District in Nine Mile Falls. She was the first female commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, and she is the founder of the nonprofit Avant-Garde Learning Foundation, and that's just the mini version of her accomplishments. Hello, Shirley. It's great to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much.
Again, this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing teaching in rural Alaska, the challenges and the joys that make teaching in the bush a unique experience. If you're out there listening and have something to share, I would like to encourage you to call in. The number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, dial 888-353-5752 or email us at hometownalaska.org. So good afternoon, Shirley. When you first taught in rural Alaska, which was actually a principal position, you moved from Anchorage to Barrow for 18 years. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And
I was actually there, Tika, 15 years, and I went back, and we started the Illisavik College my last 2 years there.
Oh, okay. So when you first moved to Barrow from Anchorage, did you experience a culture shock of sorts?
Oh, I think so. I don't think I was well prepared at all. And thank goodness the people of the North Slope were good teachers and were patient.
And Tim, the same question to you. You taught in the Yupik School District. You taught in Baltimore and in rural Arkansas before that, correct?
That is correct.
And what was it like for you going directly to the bush?
I think culture shock would probably describe it quite well. It was certainly a very different context than what I was, where I was coming from in Arkansas.
Well, I was in rural Arkansas that you were teaching, correct?
That is correct.
What was so different about rural Arkansas, besides the weather, obviously, of rural Alaska?
Well, some of the most obvious differences were that we spoke at least a certain dialect of English in southern Arkansas, and that's where I'm from. And in the Yupik School District, most of my students' first language was Yupik, and so there was that difference, and certainly all of the other complexities of cultural differences that are characteristic of the village.
Now, Shirley, speaking of the language differences, you oversee and did oversee as the Commissioner of Education all the schools in the state. Is it common still to date that so many students don't have English as a first language?
Well, in some of our communities, that's certainly still true, and most of us perceive that as a strength and not a deficit,
mm-hmm.
that particularly if they come speaking their native language in all of its richness, actually it would be wonderful if they all came to school and then we transitioned to English. But often students are coming with, a dialect of English. And so some communities are working very, very hard to maintain and preserve their language at the same time prepare their kids to be effective and efficient English speakers.
And, Tim, as a teacher, you taught predominantly grades 1 through 3, correct?
Actually, 3 through 6.
Oh, 3 through 6. Uh-huh. And coming in from Arkansas and experiencing Yupik language, how did you adjust to that to teach accordingly, to embrace their culture and at the same time be able to teach the English
right.
Curriculum?
Well, first of all, I chose to go to, I was offered several positions the year that I came to Alaska, and one of the reasons I chose the Yupik School District was because of the number of students who spoke English are rather Yupik as their first language. I really wanted to work in a indigenous language-rich environment. That was one of the reasons that I came to Alaska. And in terms of ways I adjusted, it certainly was a journey, an experience for me to figure out how to do that and do that effectively. And I, as Shirley says, I felt very unprepared for that, given my teacher ed background as well as my my experiences teaching. And so I relied heavily on my paraprofessional, who was from the community, who was fluent in Yupik and in English. And so in terms of translating and in terms of helping me learn the nuances of the communication styles, not just the language itself, which I did not learn, but different rhythms of language and so forth, by watching her and by talking with her about that, I feel that it helped me tremendously in connecting with my students, to communicate with my students.
Now, you mentioned communication nuances. I've heard a lot of teachers discuss this with me, but can you explain it for our listeners what some of those nuances are?
Well, one of the examples early on, I didn't pick up on this at first, and I was asking, I remember a day I was asking my third grade class if they wanted to do something that I knew was a positive experience, maybe go to recess earlier. I didn't remember exactly what, but it was something positive, and I felt that I wasn't getting any response, which I wasn't expecting. I was assuming they were going to jump on the idea, and it took me a while to figure out that, in fact, they were responding, but by raising their eyebrows to say yes. And so that's just one example in terms of a nonverbal. Another is the rhythm. So that when I would, coming from Arkansas, and the way that we speak there in terms of the interaction between what it looks like in the classroom, I could make a statement, ask a question, and I knew the rhythm of when the students would respond. That wasn't the same in the village where I taught. And so learning to slow down and to provide what we call wait time for students to respond is another example.
Now, this rhythm that you speak of, how do you teach teachers to be prepared for a rhythm, especially when there are so many federally mandated testing curriculums?
I think one of the best ways to teach that is have them experience it, and to place them in schools and in settings where there is a different rhythm or a different communication style, and have them experience what that's like. The same things I went through on my feet as a certified teacher, I think as we prepare field experiences in different settings, that we can have them experience that and then provide them a structure to make sense of what's happening, and to develop the skills then to teach when they are responsible, completely responsible for the curriculum.
And Shirley, as somebody who's been in a position predominantly to look at numbers and outcomes of students, do you find that there's a way with these mandated curriculums and teaching to tests and outcomes of that sort, that there is a way to make room for teachers to take the time to learn how to read the rhythms of their students?
Tika, I'd like to back up, because I think the most important thing we could do is to grow our own teachers, and certainly that's one of the programs with Avant Garde that we're working with about 100 Alaska Native people who want to become certified teachers. When Tim talks about that paraeducator or paraprofessional, you know, they are the backbone of those small rural schools, and if we can get them to be certified teachers, we can sustain things over time. And a lot of these issues that Tim's describing that we need to teach teachers would become wouldn't even be an issue anymore, hopefully. But so I guess that's one thing. And the other is that I think more and more districts are trying very hard to integrate culturally relevant materials and use those. In the state of Alaska, the state does not mandate the curriculum, and the state, the only thing they're mandating is that they want kids to know and be able to do in reading, writing, math, and science. And that's what we're assessing. And, of course, everybody wants their kids to be, you know, very, very good in those areas because we know that's a toolkit that will give them a choice when they leave school, whether they go on to college or whether they subsist and then become politically active in their village or whatever they want to do. But we've got to give them tools to have a choice.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that the state does not mandate a curriculum, but there are some things, however, that are mandated by the federal under the No Child Left Behind, correct, like the Reading First program?
Well, it depends on the level of, if the school district has not met AYP for a long period of time, then there becomes some mandates as a part of their school improvement plan. We don't have a lot of those in Alaska, but we have some. And that's where you get the feeling that something's coming on from down high. But the reality is that the standards for the state were set by the state, not the federal government.
And are they the same standards over a period of time? When were they first set?
They changed. They actually, when they were first set and we got the results back, they were modified. And in some cases, people were very angry about that because they felt like they got dumbed down. And so, you know, depending on where you're standing when you look at them, there's differences of opinion. But our standards are not the most rigorous in the United States, that's for sure.
Now, they're not the most rigorous, but, and actually I'll ask this for Tim. In your experience of teaching, and now that you're teaching teachers to teach here, the experience of what gets taught to the students of their culture, their local history, their language, are there any coursework set aside for that?
Within the teacher ed program?
Mm-hmm.
There are courses that are set aside that meet the state's multicultural studies requirement, which that is the one of the intents of that particular requirement. Rather than looking at a single course, however, the importance is that we place on this in preparing our students to work with diverse students, a diverse student population, is that the ideal is that it permeates everything that we do, that in fact it's a part of our courses, it's a part of our field experiences, it's a part of the evaluation that we do with our interns, which is also one of the state standards for teachers. They have to meet the diversity standard. And so rather than saying it's a single course, it is in fact integrated. At least that's our aim and our goal, and we're continuing to refine how we do that.
And Shirley, I'm sorry, I didn't know if you were there. Shirley, do you agree with that in a sense? Like, it's not mandated, the culture aspect for students to learn in their schools.
Well, you know, we developed in our state the culturally responsive school standards, and I know that some districts are really take those seriously, and they work hard to make sure that those are reflected in the school climate and the supportive learning environment. But you know, the reality is that we have to help teachers who go out to rural Alaska understand that they are the learner initially. They may be teaching a content or teaching something, but the reality is that they're going to have to learn about that community and the values and what they hold dear and what they want for their children. And once they demonstrate that they realize that a student who comes to them, maybe even speaking non-standard English, knows a whole lot of stuff, and that we honor the knowledge and the skills that they bring to us, and then we build on those to other things and use the examples within the community and the experiences within the community and the culture, that teacher is going to have great success.
Again, this is Hometown Alaska, and we're discussing teaching in rural Alaska today, the challenges and the joys that make teaching in the bush a unique experience. If you're out there listening and have something to share, I would like to encourage you to call in. The number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're listening from the bush, go ahead and give us a call as well, 888-353-5752, or email us at hometownalaska.org. And I'd like to take Jake, wants to talk about a new generation of teachers today. Hello, Jake. Are you there?
I am.
And where are you calling from, Jake?
Right outside Great Harvest Bread in Anchorage.
And what are you calling about exactly today?
Well, there's the Alaska Teacher Placement is kind of a network of, I think, school districts and maybe a few universities that try and place new teachers in rural Alaska. And I was really wondering if we have something else, if there's any other programs that are available somewhat similar to maybe Teach for America or AmeriCorps that can help place new teachers in rural Alaska. I know I'm from Alaska, and I have a lot of friends that are teachers in my same situation, but to be, it's not as financially doable to, or maybe it's not as financially lucrative as it once was to teach in the bush. A lot of the draw that places like Barrow and the Northwest were depending on earlier in like the 70s and 80s, it's really not there anymore. So I was wondering what kind of ideas or plans there are to encourage and entice a new generation of teachers to go out into the rural areas.
That's a great question, Jake, actually. And you're right, ATP, Alaska Teacher Placement, is in fact having its job fair this weekend, trying to place teachers all over the state. But Tim, why don't we have anything here like the Teach for America program?
I can't answer that question. I don't know why we don't have. I think that it is definitely I know it is a priority for many districts to look at how we can recruit and retain teachers. As Shirley mentioned, teachers from Alaska, growing our own, as well as filling the gaps from outside. And so I would greatly support any efforts to look at ways to do that in a systematic, with a certain system.
And are any of the curriculums that you're working with right now with the teachers over at the university, do they look at job placement as well, or just in the education aspect?
We're not focusing on the on all of the details of the placement. We do refer to the Alaska Teacher Placement. We do a lot of work when our students go out to the rural districts through our 2-week field experience. We do work with districts to provide opportunities for interviews if that's something that the student and the district is interested in doing. So in that way, we are providing opportunities.
And Shirley, did you have something to add to that?
Well, I really appreciate the call. Teach America was really aimed at urban, the tough urban schools, trying to get teachers in there. And I think it would be wonderful if we had a Teach America that was really the emphasis on going to rural, small, and where we have a high number of indigenous people. So I think that's important. The other point that the young man made, which is very critical, and that is that we have to really make sure that we work on teacher salaries so that it is a field that a person can be in and support their family and live a life that is they can pay their bills, let's say. And so anyway, I think he has some really, really, really good points to make, and I appreciate the call.
If I may quickly jump into another program that has used outside in some places is the working with Return Peace Corps volunteers, and so that's something that's something else that comes to mind as we look at possible connections to students who might already have the experiences and predispositions that would potentially be effective in rural schools as well.
And perhaps either one of you could answer this. We've spoken of locally grown teachers for Alaska. Is there a financial incentive for that?
Well, first of all, there are opportunities through the foundations of each of the corporations for students to get help. And the kind of thing that we're doing at our nonprofit, at the Avant Garde program, is that we're actually working with all the colleges and universities and providing an additional level of support to our native teacher candidates. And that's a whole other discussion about what kind of support and help do people need, particularly when they're teaching or being a teacher aide or a paraprofessional in their village, they've got a family, they're place-bound. How do we help them get from where they are to where they need to be certified? But, Tika, there's one other thing that the caller reminded me of, and that is another pool of people that we're really welcoming back in, and hopefully get some really top people into the field, are people that already have degrees in a particular area, and for whatever reason they want to start teaching. And there's opportunities for them both at the university and through the State Department. The State Department has an alternative teacher program where you actually go into the classroom and teach, and you're taking seminars and getting your certification while you're actually involved with students and learning to teach. So there's some opportunities out there for those folks, too.
Great. And just to take a step back on what we've been discussing here, I don't want to breeze over the cultural adjustments and the culture within the community and how that can still be educated in and throughout the student population. And we have Stu calling in who wants to speak especially about unculturation. Hello, Stu. Are you still there for me?
Yeah. Inculturation is the phrase that I use. It might be a politically charged phrase, too. I was just wondering, is the intent of having non-native teachers or teachers from the outside teaching in the villages to enculturate the students to the wider culture, which includes English ability? And I might comment when I hear the answers.
I think that would be a question I would defer to the school districts about in terms of why what they're wanting from their teachers. As I listen to different Alaska Native voices, for example, First Alaskan Institute, some of their reports, it's very clear that the, at least from the people they have interviewed and their data sources, that the interest is on teachers who can connect the curriculum to the local culture, and at the same time, another way to think about it is teaching through the culture, not necessarily teaching about the culture, but how do you, as Shirley mentioned, how do you, as a teacher, connect to the community, using examples from the community, which can only come by from having lived in the community and spending time there. Again, it depends perhaps on which stakeholder we're listening to.
And Shirley, did you want to comment on that?
No, I think pretty much Tim nailed it. I some school districts, I would say to you, put less emphasis on the cultural richness that students bring to them, and they see their job as preparing them in English and preparing them for an English workplace and for future training. And some communities make it very clear through their school boards and their policies and how they hire people and prepare them and orient them that they want their youngsters to be able to stand in both worlds, very tall and very capable. And it's a huge challenge for teachers. It's a huge challenge, and they need the community as a partner and the families as partners in order to make it happen.
Does that answer your question, Stu?
Well, yeah, I'm just, I lived overseas for 11 years and taught, and I've seen there, you almost have to teach the culture when you teach the language, or you end up with something that's very awkward, and it creates its own middle culture and a kind of a pigeon. What I've seen with my native friends from the village who I used to live with off and on, it's a big struggle, and I can see you guys got your hands full. And my friends, they all went back to the village, so... I guess you got to figure out where you're going to be in the future and train for it. If the problem is that you can't really see where you're going to be in the future the way things are changing so quick. So,
boy, that's for sure.
Thank you, Stu.
Thank you.
Another aspect of that, though, however, is the multicultural aspect. There are some schools that have more than just one culture attending a class. And I have spoken to several teachers in the past week who talked about how they had, especially up towards Barrow, where they had four or five different cultural entities coming into one school, or different languages, different even subsistence seasons that they were dealing with in one school. Did you experience that or at all?
Me? Mm-hmm. Not so much in Akichuk. It was, when I was teaching there, it was a Yupik village. Mm-hmm. Certainly in other places where I've taught, in Anchorage as well as in Baltimore County, there was certainly the multicultural aspect.
Is there a simple piece of advice for new teachers going into a multicultural?
I think, no, there is no simple advice, but what immediately comes to mind is, first of all, not to assume that we're going to become experts in all the cultures. We are not. I am not from all of those different cultural backgrounds, and I will never become proficient as someone indigenous to that particular culture. What's more important is a disposition of openness to learning, to including multiple voices that are represented in the classroom by drawing on the community. And so I think that's the general principle that I would share.
And Shirley, just to be clear, too, for the schools that have multicultural aspects to them, and you've spoken of the state's multi-studies requirements, does that apply to schools that have multicultural divisions?
You know, I think that is a really good question, and I can't answer it because I'm not even sure that the multicultural requirement is doing what we'd hoped it would do when it was put into place years ago, and in fact, I think it's being reviewed as we speak. So I really, really can't answer that. But I would like to add to what Tim said in that I think the best thing we can do when we're dealing with multicultural representations is to get to know the families and making them welcome and feel like we want them in the school and get to know what's in their hearts and minds and as it relates to their children, and that will help us to do a better job.
So to encourage, say, meeting a parent would help you encourage the student in which way the parents are hoping them to be encouraged? Whether
you bet.
Mm-hmm. Great.
You know, Anchorage has a really terrific program of family school coordinators in representing different language and ethnic backgrounds, and I think that that's something that can be very helpful to bridge perhaps a gap between what happens in school and what happens in a home that's culturally different.
Family school coordinators, and they're paid by the district, or?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there's some of our native language groups represented, and I know there's a Hispanic representative and others. And I know certainly they don't have all the languages, but they have some of the larger groups represented within the district, and they're trying really hard to bridge that gap.
And that's only here in Anchorage, though?
That's as far as I know. There may be other school districts that may have school coordinators. But, you know, when I was on the North Slope, when we first went there, it was predominantly, of course, the Nupiaq families and children, and then some outside folks, and then the Filipino community started moving in and taking jobs and working there, and so then there was another issue to handle, another cultural group, and that's happened in other parts of Alaska. So it's a good question, and it's something we need to address and help teachers to be prepared for.
Great. This is Hometown Alaska on KSKA. I'm your host, Tika Ballas. KSKA is listener-supported radio, and this spring's membership drive is in full swing. Here's my colleague, Pat Yak, to tell you more.
KSKA and the Alaska Public Radio Network have been in South Central Alaska for more than 30 years, bringing you the news and information you can trust. I'm Pat Yak, and I am the Vice President for News and Public Media here at KSKA. And right now, we are inviting you to call 550-8484 and pledge your financial support to keep KSKA's local news and information programs going strong on FM 91.1. The toll-free number is 800-478-5256, or you can pledge online at kska.org/support. 91.1 FM is where to tune for local, statewide, and national news and information. Each week, KSKA's locally produced call-in programs, Line 1, Your Health Connection, Talk of Alaska, and our new program about people, places, and ideas, Hometown Alaska, invite you to call in and join the conversation. Our hosts, Dr. Thad Woodard, Ellen Lockyer, Charles Wolforth, Kathleen McCoy, and Steve Heimel, keep you connected to your community with experts and guests that offer insight and information on the issues that matter to you. So call in with your pledge of support, 550-8484 or 800-478-5256. Online, ksKA.org/support. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the quality news service you deserve. Life is better with you and KSKA. In Anchorage, call 550-8484, toll-free 1-800-478-5256, or online at ksKA.org/support. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing teaching in rural Alaska. What are the challenges and joys that make teaching in the bush a unique experience? My guests are Associate Professor at UAA's College of Education, Tim Jester, and founder of Avant-Garde Learning Foundation, Shirley Holloway. I would like to give a warm welcome to all the teachers here in Anchorage right now for the Alaska Teacher Placement Job Fair this weekend. There are 52 districts in Alaska and more, or school districts, and more than 45 of them are expected to attend. That means there are a lot of teachers here in town right now. So if you're listening, or anyone else who'd like to share your experiences of teaching in the bush, or perhaps you have questions for my experienced and knowledgeable guests, give us a call. You can phone 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage and are tuning in from the bush, call 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometownalaska.org. Also, for any of the teacher resources mentioned in this show today, you can find their links at kska.org. Now, to start off, there are 53% of the schools are in the bush in this state, and 40% of the population is in the bush. Is that correct? About there? And with so many schools in the bush, yet there is still a big complaint by many teachers, and that is a lack of textbooks. As your experience, either of your experience, but Tim, your experience teaching in the bush, were you lacking textbooks and supplies?
That's a good question. Given the perhaps my experience was unique because when I arrived in the district as a newly hired teacher, the new superintendent of the school district had just received a shipment of new shiny textbooks for all the content areas. And so for our particular situation, that was not an issue. So again, perhaps that was a unique experience, but that was definitely not an issue for us.
Now, Shirley, dealing with other teachers and as a principal, have you experienced that as well?
You know, I have not. In fact, sometimes the problem is we have a lot of stuff out there, but it's not very aligned or it's not very well planned out. And as people come and go, new things are purchased over and over and over. And I think the quality of the resources are what we ought to be talking about. And what we want our kids to know and be able to do. And what has happened in the field of teaching and learning is that we have moved away from teaching the textbook, starting on page 1 and going to page 300, what we call cover the material, and then just hope the kids get some of it. We are in an accountability time where we need to be talking about what is it we want our kids to know and be able to do, whether it's at the elementary school in reading and writing and math or science and social studies, or whether we're talking about a biology class or an Algebra 1 class. What are the critical learnings? And then what materials do we need to teach those skills and that knowledge to make sure our kids have mastery? So textbooks are important. They support what it is we want kids to know and be able to do. But oftentimes we have lots of materials, but not enough time to organize them in a way so that a teacher can readily find what they need, he or she needs, to teach to that knowledge piece or to that skill.
What about additional teaching supplies, learning supplies, pen, paper, arts and crafts for the younger children? Are those hard to come by for teachers?
Perhaps in some districts. Again, it was not an issue for me in the particular school where I was located. And I cannot speak for the whole, you know, the other districts in the state today.
You got lucky. I did speak to several teachers who spoke often of how they had to be very ingenious with their methods of coming up with school supplies, and that meant going out sometimes and just collecting brush and debris and making art out of that. Do you hear anything about that when you worked as a commissioner?
Well, I think one of the sad things is that for whatever reason, art and music and some of those really important art-related fine arts in some of our schools has disappeared. And we all know that music is food for the soul, and art and drama and all of that is just as important as any other thing that we want our kids to know and be able to do. And often people say, well, they've dropped that because they have to teach just reading and math. But the reality is you can teach reading and math through art and through music and through a lot of other mediums. So first of all, I want to get that point in because I think it's really, really important. I'm sure there are some school districts that the resources may not be there for the kind of material the teacher would like. And, you know, districts get to decide. They get their money, and then they get to decide how to disperse that money and what they think is important. And that's a school board and a superintendent decision on the distribution of money and how it's spent.
Now, art and music is a big part of the culture in a lot of rural Alaska. And do you find, did you find, working as commissioner, that there are districts that embrace that aspect or try to margin that out?
Oh, I think most of the districts wanted to get the local native arts and dance and traditions into the school. I know a few examples of where they did not, and they did not feel welcome, and that was unfortunate. But by and large, I think that people who have gone to rural Alaska for all the right reasons are reaching out to those communities and want that kind of activity in the school. And then they need to participate in those activities in the community. It's reciprocal. The community and the school are one. The school just happens to be with the place. And that school belongs to that community.
That brings us to a really great email that we've received here from Chelsea Gunnerson. She teaches at the Zay G. Williams Memorial School in Napaskiuk, and she says, "We are currently having a culture week. We have elders in many classrooms teaching traditional crafts. The teachers and the students are the learners this week. This week I am learning how to tan furs and cut fish. My fiancé is learning how to bead. Another teacher is learning how to make a wooden sled. There are schools that are working hard to educate teachers." And that brings us to another point. APT, the Alaska Professional Teacher Placement, is having their big job fair this weekend, but they have posted on their site many standard questions for teachers and advice pointed out to them. And one of the things that they pointed out was that if you're coming up from the lower 48, be sure to research the area that you're applying to. And that takes us back to what Tim was just saying as well, of how you, when you move into a village, you learn all about it. You are also in a learning process, not a teaching, just a teaching process. And is there enough research you can do, Tim, before landing into a village?
I think as being as prepared as possible is certainly recommended. But being open to the realities of how the situation may actually be very different from what the book has said is something to be aware of. Probably one of the best experiences I had in my introduction to the village was the requirement by the school district at that time to have us go out and actually visit the parents before school started. And so I was accompanied by my paraprofessional, and we visited students' parents in their homes. We went out to fish camps, and it just gave me quite an introduction to the village and to the homes and families of my students. And I think that again, the preparation is certainly important to be, you know, to know something about the village before, in the region before you arrive. At the same time, we all know that there is book learning and then there is the realities of the experience. And so being open to what it's actually like once you get there is perhaps even more important, in my opinion.
Now, you currently have a grant program over at UAA where the teachers that you're teaching are going off to a village for 2 weeks to learn as well. Is that correct?
I'm working with a grant, yes, to do that.
And what has the feedback been from those students?
Overall, the students have said that's probably one of the best experiences they've had in their teacher ed program is getting that opportunity for most of them for the first time to go out to rural Alaska. There have been a few who have visited before or who are from there, but very few. The feedback is it ranges from I learned that I really would like to teach here, and we have had students take jobs after that experience, and on the other end of the continuum are those who said, I learned that this is not for me, and then everything in between, and so that's it's been a very positive experience overall.
Shirley, do you think that there's any way we could put this into a regular teacher's curriculum when going to school at the universities here, in order to teach in our rural communities here?
I would really like to see it be an opportunity for many, many more people who want to be teachers. And I'd like to have the opportunity for some folks, honestly, who've never taught anywhere except their village. Maybe they got their program, they worked online, and I'd like them to have a couple of weeks in an urban setting. One of the best professional developments, the best learning environment you can have is to go and see and do. And like Tim said, you can read about it, but if you live it and you experience it, then it's deeper, it's lasting, and it has possibly the impact to help you be better at what you're doing. And so any exchanges we can do with students and teachers and administrators will build stronger programs and understanding.
Now, Chelsea, who just emailed us, she spoke of how she was also learning as the teacher there at the school. She's just called in to follow up on her email. Hello, Chelsea.
Hi. I was just calling up to say this has been the greatest experience. I've been out here for 4 years, and it really is how much you involve yourself in the community kind of thing. One of the women from the village called me, and she knew that I hadn't been able to see them do a seal before and clean a seal, and so she said, "Do you want to come over?" And so I spent the afternoon at her house learning how to clean a seal, and we sat down and had seal lunch. And if you're willing to do those kinds of things and extend yourself out, I found that the community is very willing to let you in. We're Russian Orthodox here. We just celebrated Pascha. And I said, you know what? I know a little bit about this. I know just a little tiny bit, and I know they make Pascha bread. And so I took part of my class, and so I spent a whole day with my class learning about Pascha bread. We made Pascha bread so that the children had something to bring to the church then. So it was something the students could then say, look, we learned about this in school too. So it's making that tie that goes both ways. And we've had so many people come into the school in the last week going, that was really cool to see the kids do something in the school that they now then relate to outside there. And then this week they're bringing the community in here by doing tanning and fur sewing. Your guest just spoke about whether or not we can do exchanges between places. I've been lucky enough to be part of the Rose Urban Rural Exchange. We do an exchange between Ben Eielson and ZJ Williams. And that is one of the greatest programs that the state does provide is it's an exchange with 5 students come from an urban district with their teacher, and they come and they live in our village for a week and live in a rural community. And now this next week I get to take 5 students from the village and go to let them live at Ben Eielson. And so they get to see what an urban community is. There's lots and lots of opportunities out there in the state of Alaska, I found. You've just got to go look for them.
Great. And Chelsea, can I ask you, where did you move from to Alaska?
I moved from Michigan.
Michigan. Great. Thank you, Chelsea.
I moved from Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that is exactly what is suggested on APT's site, is that you do get involved and you take advantage of all the fantastic experiences you can have in Alaska, in rural Alaska, that you can't really have anyplace else. Are there some of them that you could share with us, Tim, that you experienced? What were some of the zaniest stepping out of your comfort zones?
I first of all, I want to say that Chelsea, I could sense her enthusiasm coming from over the line. I really appreciate her calling in and sharing that with us. And I echo everything she said in terms of the importance of that engagement and that involvement in putting ourselves out there in situations that are different and can be uncomfortable. I think for me, the opportunities to just get out into the fish camps, into the homes, led then to other opportunities to be invited to families' feasts, as they called them, for different occasions, to take steams, and to play basketball on the community, one of the teams. All those opportunities, once I found just from my own, you know, my personal experience, is that when I started taking steps to just even small steps of in being involved in the community, then that just opened doors and I think opened up the relationships and just strengthened and made my experience much more rich.
Now, would it be safe to say that since a lot of the textbooks these days are predominantly focused on the people who live within the lower 48, so a lot of times children aren't represented in the textbooks that they're using up here, correct? So in a sense, doesn't it make up for that void in their textbooks when the teacher who's teaching is more involved in their lives that way?
Well, I think it certainly can, and I want to emphasize that the importance of what I'm saying is not about the richness of experience for me, although that was, in a personal level, was great. But what it does is it helps the teacher, it helped me make those connections to students so that I then could take those shiny new textbooks I was talking about earlier were from, you know, the same textbook they might have used in Iowa or in Arkansas. And it had, you know, it was not necessarily, and it was definitely not unique to the UPS school district. And so by the experiences in the community, I then was able to make the connections, connecting the concepts, this knowledge and the skills to what was more relevant to the students. So to answer your question, yes.
Shirley, did you want to add to that at all?
Well, I think it's been well said. Chelsea, hallelujah for her, and we need a whole bunch more of her. And thank you for being a teacher, and thank you for coming to Alaska and getting so involved in the community. I know that your students must be benefiting greatly from the way you sound and your enthusiasm, so I'm just grateful. I had so many wonderful experiences, not just on the North Slope, because when I first came to Alaska, you know, I traveled to over 200 villages working with deaf and hard of hearing kids and their families and trying to figure out what we needed to do. And so, you know, I have done all the fishing stuff and the whaling, had experiences with whaling that I never would have ever had and learned so much, and people letting you in their home and they're like skinning a seal, like she was talking about, or preparing whatever. And it's just, if that's something that will benefit you personally, then it will automatically benefit the students that you serve, because they will see you in their lives in a very, very different way. And the other thing that happens is if there's a lots and lots of turnover, you know, it's really hard for people to invest in you and for the kids to invest in you, because they see a face come and a face go, and a face come and a face go. And so, you know, learning's based on trust and building relationship. And so it's so critical that we get people like a Chelsea and like our local people who become teachers who are going to stay and rejoice in all of the richness that's there and all the learning that's there in that community.
Now, there is an exceptionally high turnover rate with teachers. Is there something that people who are looking to hire teachers can be looking for so that they get more Chelseas than they do people who are going to up and leave after 1 year of teaching? Shirley? Sorry.
I wish I had the silver bullet on that one. I think there are, like Tim said, I think there's some dispositions and attitudes and beyond the skill and knowledge of being an effective teacher that we need to look for, and if people come to us and have had other experiences, really, really learning more about their previous experience and how they were perceived in their community that they're coming from can give you some insight into perhaps how well they'll adjust and contribute to the community they're going to. But it is very, very difficult. And the other difficult thing is our pool is shrinking. And so the choices that districts have is getting limited because we don't have people. Years ago, we had, I mean, literally, we had thousands of people that came to Anchorage for those teacher fairs. It'll be really interesting to see how many this year. I think last year there was only, I don't know, we'd have to ask the folks, but probably only 450, maybe 500 people.
And Tim, you were hired out of this job fair.
I was, and it was at a time when I, you know, there was 2,000 or 3,000 teacher applicants at that job fair, and I felt really lucky to even to get an interview. There were people on the plane with me as I was returning back to the South that you know, that were here for the job fair and didn't even get an interview with the district. So, yeah, that was the way it was then.
Well, we have a lot of topics I still want to cover in just a little bit more time, but Greta's calling up to perhaps correct me. Hello, Greta. How are you doing?
Hi there. Good, thanks. How are you?
Well, great. Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you.
And you're calling with a correction?
Yeah, I'm with the Alaska Humanities Forum, and I work in the Rose Urban Rural Exchange, and we work with Chelsea Gunnarsson there in Neposkiak and her sister's school in Eielson. Delighted to have them on board this year, but I just wanted to call with a minor correction. It's actually not a state program. The Rose Urban Rural Exchange is a program of the Alaska Humanities Forum, and we operate off of a U.S. DOE grant, so Department of Education grant from the federal
Great.
Department.
Well, thank you for that clarification, Greta. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And now, to quickly sum up really fast, there are a couple of other issues that teachers deal with in rural Alaska that you don't see teachers dealing with anyplace else, and that is the subsistence seasons. I know in Dillingham, I've heard teachers speak of the herring season, and up north, the whaling season. Now, there are some mandates by state and federal government about how many students are supposed to be in your class when you begin a school year. How do teachers deal with subsistence seasons that are still going on through the month of August? Shirley, you can go ahead and answer that.
One way that we did, I guess maybe back in the dark ages, no, I'm just teasing, was that we actually had each community set a calendar, a school calendar that respected those different times of year when there would be some traditional activities going on. And I think that's one way it can be dealt with. You know, there is nothing sacred about starting in September and ending in June. That's the farmer calendar. And so I would like to see our districts have a lot of flexibility. And I think they do, as long as they get their 180 days in, which, by the way, are not enough days anyway. But that's another topic. But I think that it is important to recognize the subsistence activities and that the fact that the students will want to participate in those.
And, Tim, how did you respectfully deal with teaching and keeping your curriculum moving with subsistence seasons?
That was definitely something that that I experienced in Akyachuk. And over time, what happened with me, and part of the just my own education, is coming to an appreciation of the importance of subsistence in the community. And not that I understand it or that I participated in it, but that it obviously, it became very obvious to me that this was an extremely important, deeply rooted in their culture activity. And so I felt that it was my job to look at ways that I could support that while also carrying out my responsibility as a teacher. And so, of course, I was teaching in the elementary school, and I don't know how this may play out if you are teaching upper-level math or some of the other content areas in terms of students being gone. But for me, it was an opportunity to look at creative ways to be supportive of what was important in the local community while at the same time making sure that I provide opportunities for students to make up what they didn't participate in, providing journaling activities that they could actually do, not that they're out writing all night or reading from the class on their subsistence trip, but that there are opportunities to make connections between subsistence activities and what we're doing in school.
And Shirley, there's so many topics still, and this is a really big one. But just recently, last month, in fact, the Alaska Superior Court judge said the state's Department of Education is failing. And in the Yupik School District, for instance, there is only 1 in 10 10th graders considered grade level for math. The court has issued a statement that gives the department 2 months to come up with a remedy for the situation. Now, this all stems back, in some ways, to there being a desire for preschool and kindergarten. There currently is no preschool or kindergarten in rural Alaska?
Oh, there are in different communities. Some communities have Head Start, and some communities, the school districts have worked to get four-year-old, three- and four-year-old programs. They've had them for a long time, and they just they pay for that out of their regular budget, but that's not available to everyone, that's for sure. It's going to be very interesting to see how that ultimately plays out. I think there's more to come as it relates to that in terms of how the state's going to actually handle that.
And in your opinion?
A difference of opinion about all of that, as you can imagine.
Oh, absolutely. As Tim brought up earlier, this argument has been going on for quite some time. Isn't that correct?
Yes, I just was looking at some literature recently, and I came across the Merriam Report from 1928, which was a U.S. Government commissioned report looking into, in part, Indian education. And so there were recommendations that were made, and one of those was to provide preschool education. Another was to increase the number of indigenous teachers. Another was to incorporate language, tribal language, and culture into the schools. So it will be interesting to see what we can do at the state level in 2 months, given the context that these issues and recommendations have been going on for many, many years.
Before we go any further, there was one other thing I just wanted to share with your audience, and that is that some of the school districts have done some really marvelous work around developing curricula. For instance, I know that one district has a whaling curriculum, and it's performance-based. So if a student at the middle school, high school level is participating in the event of whaling, they actually have a curriculum, and they have to demonstrate some proficiencies as it relates to that experience. And I know that other districts have some really beautiful materials that they have developed to teach the standards that incorporate the local community and culture. And back to the court case, I think it's kind of a wait and see what happens. I do want to say that I recently just got off the State Board of Education. I've been on there for quite a while, and I have seen the state develop a very comprehensive system of support to help schools improve. And I don't know how the implementation is going district by district, but I know that there's been a lot of work going on in terms of helping districts to look at those areas that are going to make a difference in student achievement.
Well, Tim and Shirley, I can't believe that this hour has actually already gone up, and I feel that there's so much still to discuss on this topic, but I want to thank you both for joining me, and everyone for listening today. Thank you for joining me and my guests, Associate Professor, UAA's College of Education, Tim Jester, and founder of Avant-Garde Learning Foundation, Shirley Holloway. Next week, on Wednesday, April 21st, join Hometown Alaska's host, Charles Wolforth, and his guests as they discuss civility in civic discussion, and how to have productive, friendly debates. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Speck engineered today's program with assistance from Constance Huff. Thanks for listening. I'm Tika Ballas, and this has been Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.